From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Africa, can it rebound from a devastating decade? We'll talk with New York Times reporter John Darton about his three-part series. He says the World Bank is the new superpower in post-Cold War Africa. The era of the president for life is over, but ethnic fighting could get worse. Also today, the sex goddess of the Western Hemisphere, who's only kidding. We talk with Maggie Estep, one of the emerging stars of the new spoken word scene. She was part of MTV's Spoken Word Tour and has a new album called No More Mr. Nice Girl. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Ill Communication, the new album from the Beastie Boys. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Attorney General Janet Reno says her agency is looking into charges that tobacco company executives may have lied to Congress and federal regulators. Reno says the Justice Department's civil, criminal, and antitrust divisions are all looking into the matter, but the agency hasn't determined if it should open a full investigation. The review was prompted by a letter from seven members of Congress who cited allegations of possible criminal wrongdoing by the tobacco companies. Meanwhile, a group of senators has introduced a new bill that would let the federal government sue tobacco companies. This would be a way for the federal government to recoup the health costs it pays for tobacco-related illnesses. Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey described the legislation.
The legislation by itself does not compel the tobacco companies to pay any specified amount. It simply lets the federal government file kind of a class action suit on behalf of the taxpayers to help pay the health care costs of tobacco use.
Meanwhile, Mississippi's attorney general says as many as eight states may decide to sue the tobacco industry for the same reason. The New Jersey Supreme Court has issued a significant ruling in a highly publicized case involving charges of child sexual abuse. Gene Dillard reports from Trenton.
Margaret Kelly Michaels, the former teacher at a Maplewood, New Jersey daycare center, was first convicted of sexual assault on children at the facility, but then acquitted by a three-judge appellate panel. Now, the state's highest court has handed her another legal victory. It ruled investigators' interrogations of youngsters in the case were improper because they were coercive and suggestive. Michael's lawyer, Alan Zegas, says the interviews of the children were outrageous.
The interrogation employed here went so far as to threaten and even bribe children, and those techniques could well have shaped the children's responses and memories.
The court said if the case is retried, a hearing must be held first to determine the reliability of evidence gathered from the improper interviews of children. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
There are questions about the arrest of O.J. Simpson. The Associated Press is quoting a source who says Los Angeles investigators wanted to arrest Simpson within hours of the murders of his ex-wife and a friend of hers. But the AP source says the officers were told by Police Chief Willie Williams' office to move cautiously because Simpson was a celebrity. A police spokesman denies any such orders were given. The government is reporting a surge in factory orders for long-lasting durable goods. The Commerce Department says durable goods orders rose 0.9% in May. This is the ninth increase in the last 10 months. Durable goods orders are rather durable goods or long-lasting items like computers and appliances. They're considered a key measure of how well the manufacturing sector is doing in the economy. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 30 points at 3,695. The Nasdaq is down 12 at 700. This is NPR. Consumer groups say a warning label system for cars won't do enough to prevent 220,000 rollover accidents every year. The president of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety says consumer information is important, but he says it's no substitute for a safer vehicle. Transportation Secretary Federico Peña is proposing a new safety sticker that would include a rating system along with a sticker price. The label would detail the chances of a rollover accident. Peña says the information could be expanded to include material on passenger protection in front and side impact crashes. French troops headed for Rwanda on a humanitarian mission are now beginning to enter that country after landing in Zaire and the Central African Republic. 2,500 troops have been dispatched, but only a few will go into Rwanda. Ben Brown filed this report for the BBC.
The French are calling it Operation Turquoise. 2,000 of their troops are being mobilized here in Central Africa.
and many have already arrived at Goma on the Rwanda-Zaire border. Their mission, according to Paris, is to help end the slaughter in Rwanda that's already claimed as many as 500,000 lives. The French insist that their soldiers are embarking on a purely humanitarian operation that will last only a few weeks. The troops here are all under strict orders not to penetrate deep into Rwanda. If they do, they know they could encounter fierce resistance there. This French decision effectively to go it alone has been greeted with considerable skepticism by the international community and by aid workers and UN officials in Rwanda, who fear that it could just make things there worse.
Ben Brown reporting. U.S. Catholic bishops are criticizing a United Nations draft plan to control population growth. The bishops say economic development, not abortion and contraception, should be worked on to ease the strain of growing world population. They're denouncing the Clinton administration for wanting to liberalize abortion policy. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. France is moving troops into Rwanda in a humanitarian mission to protect civilians. Rwanda is perhaps the most extreme example of what has gone wrong in parts of Africa. My guest John Darton wrote a three-part front-page series on Africa, published earlier this week in the New York Times. His series was called Survival Test: Can Africa Rebound? Darton's articles help put the headlines into a larger context. Many African countries south of the Sahara have experienced devastating economic failure in the past decade. 18 of the world's 20 poorest countries are African. Darton says economic crisis is undercutting a drive for political liberalization, raising ethnic rivalries to a dangerous level, and forcing countries to impose inflammatory austerity programs. Darton is the New York Times London bureau chief. He covered Africa for the Times in the late 70s. I asked him why he returned to write this series.
It was my first foreign assignment for the Times, and I think for a foreign correspondent, there's always a bit of nostalgia and romance that attaches itself to the first place where he or she has been. And especially this is true of Africa, which is a continent that's so vivid in so many ways and in colors and sights and sounds. So I had not been there for some 14, 15 years. And frankly, I missed it a great deal.
You describe Africa as the only continent where most poor people are getting poorer. Can you give us a sense of the pattern in Africa that you see now?
It's very visible, and you can see it all across the board. If you've been away from the continent for a long time and then you return, and especially if you travel outside the cities to the countryside, where, after all, 80% of the people still live, you can notice a marked deterioration in everything from the quality of the roads, which are now filled with potholes, to living standards. It's now not uncommon to see children, street children, in most of the capital cities, which was something that was almost unheard of before because of the tight extended family structure. You can go into villages and talk to people and find out that they're eating, in some cases, only one meal a day. And often the meals are just subsistence level, manioc root or something like that. There is a general tattered look that I think is worse than before. So almost in every way, visually, as well as just anecdotally, you can see that conditions have in fact gotten worse.
How much do the deteriorating conditions have to do with natural disasters like drought and flood?
Well, that's, of course, the major question. A great deal does have to do with phenomenon over which there's no control, and including the encroachment of the Sahara Desert. But what interested me was the fact that this kind of disaster has been occurring off and on now for many decades in Africa, and yet the continent always had a resilience before. When I lived there in the late 70s, there were plagues of locusts, there were occasional droughts, and there were even sporadic famines. But now when they occur, and especially when they occur in conjunction with war, it seems to totally devastate a wide area, causing deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, and the area does not seem to recover quickly. That strikes me as a new and rather ominous phenomenon.
With this combination of natural disaster and war.
I think the two have come together now in a particularly deadly combination. And it's not just war, but the kind of war that's being waged.
How has that changed?
Well, curiously enough, the wars now seem to be even more brutal, even in terms of just the death toll. If you look at some of the ongoing conflicts in the southern Sudan, in Mozambique, which is now winding down, but especially in Angola and in Liberia, these are areas that have had conflict for a long time, but suddenly it seems worse. That is to say, rebel groups or government forces come into villages, simply destroying the villages, kidnapping the women, drafting young teenage or pre-teenage soldiers to fight with them. There's no holds barred now, and the use of famine as a weapon of war is being seen increasingly, so that all of these things come together and make for a much more dire situation than, say, in the mid to late 70s or early 80s.
How is famine being used as a weapon of war?
Well, you remember Somalia and all the attempts to raid warehouses and either withhold food from the enemy clans or using food to distribute through the army to civilians that are distinctly on your side, or in most cases diverting the food into the army. So it's food has now become a prime objective of a lot of the fighting that's going on. And you would expect this to increase, of course, in times of scarcity.
You write that most of the economies of sub-Saharan nations went into a tailspin in the 80s. What threw them into a tailspin?
Again, that's a difficult question, but they did suffer shocks in the 70s with the rise in oil prices. And then most of the countries, of course, like Ghana or Ivory Coast, are dependent on a prime commodity to earn their exports, either coffee or cocoa or something along that line, or farther in the south, minerals. The markets for these commodities went into a tailspin in the 80s. And because they were the single main export earner, the entire economy went down the drain with it. That's only one factor. It's one that's cited a lot by African nations themselves. There are a whole lot of hidden factors, ranging from mismanagement to corruption to poor economic policies that are not quite as readily admitted, but are perhaps equally significant.
My guest is John Darton, and he had a three-part series earlier this week in the New York Times called Survival Test, Can Africa Rebound? During the Cold War, the superpowers saw Africa as a chessboard in which, communism versus democracy was being played out. Now that the Cold War is over, what powers are filling that vacuum?
Well, that's the great paradox. During the Cold War, of course, it was simply the United States and the Soviet Union fighting, in effect, a proxy confrontation through their client states. Now, both countries, in fact, the European nations as well, seem to have disengaged and withdrawn. And there is a vacuum there. Into it has rushed some of the large Western financial institutions, namely the World Bank and the IMF. And these two institutions together more or less run the economies of some 29 actually, of the 49 sub-Saharan countries.
For those of us who mentally change channels whenever IMF or World Bank is mentioned, can you just give us a brief sense of what do they do?
Ah, very good question. Well, they were not set up to do this, of course. They were set up 50 years ago to tide industrialized nations over when they have a temporary problem with, say, their balance of payments. But instead now, the IMF will come into a country that is destitute, financially bankrupt, pull together the government, the ministers, and say, all right, here's what we can do. We can help you out of this mess. We can open lines of credit to you so that you can get your budgets back in balance a little bit, help your imports, feed some of your people. But in return, you must agree to do the following things. And then there will follow a prescription of sometimes rather drastic steps, most of them designed to bring the countries into a more free market economy or to somehow minimize governmental interference. Financial experts would say these steps make sense. But the trouble is they really are steps that are undertaken from the point of view of Western industrialized economies, and the social costs are considerable. invariably it means things like bread will rise in price, or that people who want to use a hospital will have to pay a fee to use the hospital. Those are hard things to ask the governments to impose, especially if they feel their positions are a bit shaky to begin with.
So in the short term, a lot of people feel victimized by the World Bank policies.
They do. And, of course, the World Bank, it must be said, is a convenient whipping boy for some of the governments who can say, after all, we're not doing this. We're not the ones who are imposing this on you. We're just doing it because we're told to do it. That's something, I think, that's hard for any government anywhere in the world to admit to, but it's one that essentially passes the blame onto an outside external force, and so it becomes a convenient method.
Well, how much power does the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have to actually call the shots in an African country?
I'd say quite a bit. It certainly goes beyond the economic conditions, which you might expect. They are very adamant in pressuring countries, for example, to undertake multi-party elections. Now, that is obviously in many cases a good thing to do. But it does seem to exceed the mandate a little bit of a distant financial regulator that is supposed to be there to really help out in an emergency.
So how many countries are the World Bank and the IMF in on?
About 29 at any one point. And of the 29, they have identified six, which they say are doing well. One of the six, Nigeria, which is by far the largest, has since dropped out. So there are now five, meaning five countries are more or less fully adhering to the World Bank IMF program of austerity measures and beginning to show small increments of growth. This is a very modest step, but some see it as a hopeful one.
What are some of the arguments that you heard pro and con for these big financial institutions?
Sure. The argument con is a very strong one, which is basically African countries, many of them feel they have given over part of their sovereignty to an outside institution which doesn't have the same the welfare of its citizens at heart the way the government might. The argument pro is also a strong one, which is in most cases this is medicine that's very bitter to taste, but medicine that's necessary to take if the economies are to eventually improve. The problem is the length of time it will take to work. The latest World Bank report, which came out I think in March, estimated that even these modest levels of growth will take some 40 years for the countries to return to the level of prosperity they had in the mid-1970s. That means basically an entire generation is wiped out. You're telling somebody who is born today that in his or her lifetime, their prospects will not improve at all and may in fact get a little worse.
For an African country that's broke, is there any alternative besides a big loan coming with the agenda of the World Bank?
Well, I think, frankly, that it's very hard for a lot of these economies, especially in northern countries like Burkina Faso, where they are faced with desert encroachment, to ever reach the point where there is a meaningful industry or even small industry where products can be made with value added and then exported to bring in money. I think to get the economies going, there will have to be an international movement to forgive the debt of all African countries south of the Sahara is now about $180 billion. That's a tremendous sum. That means that they spend $10 billion a year just to pay off interest, and that's four times what they all spend in health and education. So unless there's movement there, I see little hope in the short run, at least, that the economies will turn around.
John Darton is my guest. He's the London correspondent for The New York Times. Earlier this week, he had a three-part series that ran on the front page of The Times about Africa. We're going to continue our conversation after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. John Darton is my guest, and we're talking about his series that ran earlier this week in the New York Times, Survival Test, Can Africa Rebound? Your series is not only about what happened after the end of the Cold War in Africa, but you write, too, that this is the end of the President for Life era. That era is over. What's the evidence that that era is over?
Well, it's really an interesting development. Since 1990, there has been in many, many African countries proclamations of democracy, of multi-party states, and elections. The elections have varied in character all the way from those that are probably directly rigged to those that are, according to international observers, very honest. There is a movement afoot for political change throughout Black Africa. It's natural when you consider that Africans are not immune to developments elsewhere in the world, and they've been watching what happens in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And some of the same pressures are working on governments there.
Of course, on the downside, you say that one-man rule in some places is being replaced by no-man rule. I guess Somalia might be an example of that.
Somalia certainly is an example. Liberia is another example. And, of course, the prime example of all, the gold standard in these things, is Zaire. Zaire has been under President Mobutu for many years now, several decades. And when I was there last, he totally controlled the country. That is to say, his image was everywhere. It was on the money. It was over the desk of every bureaucrat. It descended on the evening news at night from a montage of clouds. And he was simply everywhere. Now, curiously enough, he's still in power, but the power is shared to some degree. And he just does not seem to be a presence at all. He's almost never in the capital. There is no sense of any authority whatsoever. The army goes unpaid and is sort of foraging through the countryside. There's no suggestion that the government is capable of performing any service whatsoever, and it's very close to anarchic conditions.
In Eastern Europe, the end of communism ended up bringing a lot of ethnic fighting, fighting for power. Is there an equivalent in Africa now? The end of one-man rule has, in its own way, created a new problem, which is more ethnic fighting and political fighting like we're seeing in Rwanda and Burundi?
Well, that question hits the jackpot, because that's the question Africans seem to be asking themselves wherever I went. There are countries such as Kenya where you now sense ethnic tension to a very high degree that was not there to quite the same degree before, and it is a dangerous situation. I was most impressed to hear Africans talk about Rwanda, because often from a distance it looks to be simply a case of unbelievable and almost inexplicable savagery. And we see massacres of Tutsis by Hutus, and we wonder, how could this happen? It's simply a playing out of ancient hatreds. But when you get a little closer to the situation, you do see that there are, in a sense, explanations for it, and that many Africans say that pressures were brought to bear upon Rwanda to change its political course too quickly, to remove one group from power and substitute another, and that all of this contributed to the atmosphere that allowed it to happen. They're not totally blaming, of course, outsiders for it, but they say democracy can be a two-edged sword and you must be careful or it could strike the wrong way.
What are the pressures and outside influences they're referring to?
Well, foreign countries, especially Belgium, France, and even the United States, brought pressure to bear upon the authorities in Rwanda, in Burundi, even including some from Uganda, which is involved in the situation there, to get together in Arusha, the town in Tanzania, and to try and sort out some of the differences. This is obviously a positive step, and it's something that should have been done. But at the same time, some Africans detect pressure to change, perhaps to change even too quickly, that some groups inside Rwanda saw as obviously a threat to their own privileged positions. So the lesson, I was told, is that change should come from within a country. It should be organic to the country, and it's not something that can be imposed from the outside.
Well, people in power never want to give up the power
this
one
is
way
true.
Or another.
This is absolutely true. But there is can be an internal pressure that's equally strong or even stronger than external pressures, and South Africa is a case in point there, I think.
But, of course, in South Africa, you had external pressure, too. You had boycotts against South Africa.
Yes, you did, and also economic sanctions. All of that, I think, really added to the pressure. But then, don't forget, there was the primarily, I think, it was the situation inside the country that brought the government to the realization that it had to adapt.
What were the different takes that you heard about South Africa in your travels through Africa?
Well, it's interesting. Almost every African capital has a street named after Nelson Mandela and has had for many years. He's got a almost a mythic stature throughout most of Africa. So the image of Mandela winning the election, finally bringing the last country in southern Africa under majority rule, and doing so with such grace and sense of purpose was an inspiring one, I think, throughout much of the continent. What I heard Africans remark on almost more than anything else was the president's ability to bring the opposition into the government. At one point, I know he gave an interview in which he said he was just as glad that the opposition actually won so much that he would not have over 66% of the votes and therefore could not unilaterally draw up the next constitution. This notion that you would actually want to nurture an opposition is a new one in a number of countries. And it made some Africans, I think, African leaders, think perhaps you can actually have a more stable government if you do include the opposition than if you exclude the opposition. So it's a very positive influence throughout Africa.
So did you see Rwanda and South Africa as being the two different directions that African countries can head in now, the two different extremes?
Absolutely, I think so. One is a case, one is a dream and the other is a nightmare. One is an example of careful evolutionary and yet dramatic change, and the other is a cataclysm, something just gone horribly wrong.
A lot of Americans get inspiration from Africa, yet also feel a sense of despair because of the condition so many African countries are in now. How much pessimism, how much optimism did you find in your travels?
Well, most of the pessimists about Africa, many of them tend to be outsiders, curiously enough. There is a term called Afro-pessimism, which is leveled at anyone who just sees everything in dark colors and going down the drain. But the wonderful thing about the continent is its resilience, its strength, and its hope for the future. It's the youngest continent by far, and it does not take long to see that there are some hopeful signs. There are definitely countries that are improving every day, such as Uganda. There are hopeful developments, one of which is that many people now are beginning to demand things from their governments. They're not just passively waiting for the government to do something. There are new creative thinkers trying to come up with new ways of approaching these problems with African solutions and not simply importing things from the outside. So there's also a lot of there are a lot of positive developments, I think.
John Darton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
John Darton is London Bureau Chief of the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, MTV's Poet Laureate. We talk with Maggie Estep about her hybrid of spoken word and raw rock and roll. Her new album is called No More Mr. Nice Girl. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest album by the Beastie Boys. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala is accusing critics of the president's health care plan of trying to derail his welfare plan, too. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Speaking before the National Press Club, Shalala argued that the president's plan for a 2-year time limit, followed by a work requirement, is a bold centrist bill. She blasted a conservative think tank known as Empower America for proposing that the welfare system should simply be eliminated and that the children of unwed teen mothers be sent to orphanages or put up for adoption.
It's a 1994 version of Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal, which argued that the best way to deal with food shortages and overpopulation was to eat the children of the poor.
While Shalala was criticizing what she called a small group of ultra-rightists, she also called for a bipartisan effort to reform welfare and indicated that the administration could find a middle ground with more moderate Republican proposals. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
French troops have begun to enter Rwanda. They're going to try to protect Rwandan citizens in danger of being murdered. The United Nations Security Council has just approved the French mission. Rwandan rebels who are fighting the Rwandan government oppose the French action. They say France has always backed the government, even though government troops are thought to have been responsible for most of the slaughter. The French government helped the Rwandan government defeat the rebels in 1990. Israeli soldiers have killed 2 armed Palestinians and captured a 3rd inside the self-declared Israeli security zone in southern Lebanon. The army says the Palestinians were trying to get into Israel. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Lebanese security sources say the 3 Palestinians, members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, were spotted by an Israeli patrol near the border town of Nakura. 2 were killed in an exchange of gunfire. The 3rd was captured a short time later. The incident is part of the almost daily fighting in southern Lebanon between Israel and its enemies, including the pro-Iranian Hezbollah guerrillas. A Lebanese soldier was killed today when a rocket fired by one of the sides landed near the town of Nabatea during an artillery battle. And a Hezbollah guerrilla commander was killed when a roadside bomb blew up as he was driving out of his village in southern Lebanon. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
No movement is reported in the United Auto Workers strike against Caterpillar. The president of the heavy equipment maker is asking workers to cross picket lines. The company says 1,100 workers did so on Tuesday and more crossed yesterday. The United Auto Workers says its picket lines are solid. It's accusing Caterpillar of inflating the numbers of people who crossed the picket lines because it's trying to scare employees back to work. On Wall Street, worries about higher interest rates drove stock prices lower. The Dow dropped 26 points to end the day at 3,699. Declines clobbered advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Transportation Department wants all new automobiles to have a label disclosing whether the vehicle has a tendency to roll over in crashes or sharp turns. But the sticker proposal has come under fire from consumer groups and auto manufacturers. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Transportation Secretary Federico Peña says the new labels would detail a vehicle's propensity to roll over in accidents, but could be expanded to include data on passenger protection in frontal and side impact crashes. Peña says by rating safety among vehicles and within classes of vehicles, the American consumer will now be able to express their purchasing decisions much more directly to the manufacturers of these vehicles. The president of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety says the new labels don't go far enough. Judith Stone says the solution is more stable vehicles and more forgiving interiors. Interest groups say a warning label on new cars isn't enough to deal with the 220,000 rollover accidents each year. Manufacturers contend that the safety problem is with how the driver handles the vehicle, not with how the vehicle is built. The Transportation Department plans to hold public hearings across the country to ask consumers what additional safety information they want on auto stickers. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A published report says top Washington officials likely won't be indicted in the Whitewater probe. The Wall Street Journal reports it spoke with about a dozen White House and Treasury Department officials who say they haven't gotten any notices their clients could be indicted. Such notice would come from the Whitewater Special Counsel, who's looking into a failed savings and loan and a real estate deal made by President Clinton and the First Lady. South Africa has reclaimed its seat in the United Nations General Assembly after being ousted in 1974. The country's return is due to its repeal of apartheid and election of an all-race government. The South African ambassador took his seat today, accompanied by the South African foreign minister and applause. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new poetry scene flourishing in rock clubs, performance spaces, and even on MTV. My guest Maggie Estep is one of the emerging stars. Sometimes she performs alone, sometimes with her rock band I Love Everybody. She recently was on the MTV Spoken Word Tour, and this summer she'll be part of the big alternative rock and hip-hop event, the Lollapalooza Tour. Estep lives in New York, where she's often performed at the New Eurekan Poets Cafe. She has a new CD called No More Mr. Nice Girl. Here's the opening track. Maggie Estep, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks.
So, do the men yo-yo all the time in your neighborhood?
Well, it's a pretty frequent thing, yeah, unfortunately, yeah. Even where I, you know, when I wear, you know, a tent or something out, you know, it's like, hey, nice tent, babe.
So are you the kind of person who usually talks back on the street, or do you just save it for your music?
Well, I kind of save it because it's often dangerous to talk back. You know, you might get shot or something. But when I'm on my bike and I'm going fast, I will talk back. You know, I'll say something, you know, ludicrous. Something right. that, you know, something sort of off the wall that really, you know, makes them, you know, pause and think, wow, what does that mean?
Like, what have you said?
Oh, you know, I just proposition them back, you know, with something completely absurd, like, I don't know, any number of things involving gardening or bathrooms or, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Now, Maggie, you used to sing with your band. How did you start doing spoken word?
Well, I've done spoken word, you know, for a while since I was, you know, I don't know, like 22 or something. And then I did that. And then the band was a separate entity. And then the spoken word thing, I started getting so much work doing that I left my band. But then I got a record deal and we needed music. So my band and I wrote stuff to go with the spoken word stuff and sort of created a new hybrid of rock and roll and poetry or spoken word or something.
So you were writing poetry all along?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, since I was, 10 or something.
What are the poetry slams that you've been a part of?
Poetry slams are vicious competition. No, it's what, you know, you'll have four or five poets and each poet gets up there and reads a poem and is judged. You know, they pick judges out of the audience at random and they judge from 1 to 10. They score you from 1 to 10. And then each round, you know, a poet is eliminated who gets a low score and then it's down, you know, neck to neck, with two poets and then finally somebody wins. And it's, you know, it's a kind of, it gives poetry a new dimension and brings in a new kind of audience who are out to see blood, you know?
Did it mean a lot to you the first time you won a slam?
I was pretty shocked, you know, and then I kept winning them, and I couldn't figure it out for the life of me. But, you know, I guess part of the reason I don't take it so seriously is that I always win, you know. If I always lost, I might feel differently.
You have a very assertive voice.
Uh-huh.
And I find that really interesting because I think we're in a period when a lot of women, particularly younger women, almost can't find their voice, that a lot of women have that rising inflection and a very tentative-sounding voice that seems trapped in the throat and seems to be a sign of insecurity.
Yeah, I do kind of notice that. I mean, there is this weird cultural trend in timid women and you know, and exemplified on like magazine covers where everyone, you know, like these big these models who are making all this money look completely helpless and childlike. And I find it incredibly annoying. I don't know. I mean, I'm, you know, in your face.
Did you always have that kind of assertive voice?
I think so. I mean, I'm actually really shy and certainly have my own particular insecurities. But yeah, I mean, I always have been like, I was never victim girl, you know. I was always like, I'm going to, you know, do what I want. Thank you very much. Get out of my way, you know.
Can I ask you to do one of your poems for us now, something without music?
Sure. I'll do a new one. It's called I'm an Emotional Idiot, So Get Away From Me. I'm an emotional idiot, so get away from me. I mean, come here. Wait, no, that's too close. Give me some space. It's a big country. There's plenty of room. Don't sit so close to me. Hey, where are you? I haven't seen you in days. What, are you having an affair? Who is she? Come on, aren't I enough for you? God, you're so cold. I never know what you're thinking. You're not very affectionate. I mean, you're clinging to me. Don't touch me. What am I, your cat? Don't rub me like that. Don't you have anything better to do than sit there fawning over me? Don't you have any interests, hobbies, sailing, fly fishing, archaeology? There's an archaeology expedition leaving tomorrow. Why don't you go? I'll loan you the money. Money. My money is your money. My life is yours. My soul is yours. Without you, I'm nothing. Move in with me. We'll get a studio apartment together. Save on rent. Well, wait, I mean, maybe a one bedroom so we don't get in each other's hair or anything. Or, well, maybe a two bedroom. I'll have my own bedroom. It's nothing personal. I just need to be alone sometimes. You do understand, don't you? Hey, where are you going? What? Was it something I said? I'm an emotional idiot, so get away from me. I mean, marry me.
a little approach avoidance there. So is this an autobiographical set of mixed messages?
Yes, definitely.
My guest is Maggie Estep. Her new CD is called No More Mr. Nice Girl. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Maggie Estep is my guest. I'm interested in your background. I know you moved around a lot when you were young. What did your father do for a living?
He was a horse trainer, an eccentric horse trainer who, like, would always end up working for really wealthy people, you know, managing their horse stables, and then would get irritated and quit his job, and we would move. And so we moved a lot. You know, we moved about every 4 months or so. And it was kind of fun. You know, it was kind of a gypsy existence.
Did you do anything to compensate for the fact that you were always the new kid in school, the new kid on the block?
I just cultivated being, you know, I mean, it was always, it was like, oh, who's that new weirdo? So I just sort of cultivated that. I just kind of went with that. It was like, okay, I'm a weirdo, so I'm going to go with that. And you know, and I just would be as deliberately eccentric as possible after a while.
What would you do to be deliberately eccentric?
Well, you know, I got into the whole punk thing, so I had all my hair shaved off and tons of earrings, and this was like long before, you know, there were a lot of people like that walking around. So, you know, I had that going on, and I don't know. I just would always dress strangely and you know, yeah.
Now, in spite of the fact that you've always read a lot and you've been writing since you were 10, you dropped out of high school, right?
I did because, part of that was, I mean, I'd gone to like 7 high schools.
Oh, gosh.
And I got to this one final high school that was academically the second best public high school in the United States, and I had just come from like probably one of the worst, and so I was totally lost, and then somebody offered me a job in Manhattan, and I was like, okay, I'll go do that instead, and I moved to Manhattan.
What was the job?
Oh, working at a record company, and I was 17. And there I was, little punk. I ended up getting fired because of my hairdo.
At a record company,
yes,
they fired you?
Yes, yes.
Boy, it must have been pretty raucous hairdo if they fired
it was.
You for that.
It was pretty nasty, actually.
What was it?
You know, these little dreadlocks, and they were really dirty, and they were, like, dyed a very strange color. And, you know, Barry Manilow came in one day, and there I was in the reception area, and I guess he complained, and, you know.
Huh. So were you performing punk music?
No, I was in a couple bands, but we never got gigs so, at that point. So no, I never did.
Now, you were a junkie for a while as a teenager?
Yeah, I was, you know, completely out of control for a while, and then, yeah.
How did you start on it?
I don't know. It was just, you know, it was around my neighborhood and it just, you know, and people I was meeting and stuff. And I just sort of said, I'll try. You know, whenever I do something, I go all the way with it. I'm very black and white person. You know, I never do things in half measures. And so I was like, okay, this is what I'll do now. And, you know, quickly, you know, went through a lot of friends and a lot of jobs and a lot of apartments and ended up like, you know, homeless and like staggering down the street and stuff. And then, you know, went out to Colorado and got my head together and have remained with my head together.
How long were you homeless?
Not that long. I mean, I don't know. It was a couple of months, but I wasn't completely homeless. You know, I was, people would put me up now and then, and then there were like, you know, 4 nights in a row where I was just staying on a roof somewhere.
So how did you get out of this?
Let's see, how did I get, well, there was, you know, there was a detox, a rehab, a halfway house and all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, that was basically it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I left New York for a while. And that's when I, you know, decided, oh, now I'm going to go to school. I'm not going to be a drug addict anymore. And I went to college and all that.
Huh. So when you went back to school, did you study writing?
I did, yes. I went to Naropa out in Boulder, and I studied writing and literature.
When you were on the streets, did you think, well, one day I'm going to be a writer?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was, you know, I was walking around with pen and paper always and continually trying to write these various novels. And, you know, I was trying. And then, you know, when I went out to Colorado and I cleaned up and stuff, then I start, you know, just start pouring out of me.
So how did you go from this life of addiction and destitution to then going back to school for a while and emerging as a writer and performer?
I'm lucky. I don't know. You know, I mean, I just, I mean, it's that same, that thing I have in me where I never do anything halfway. You know, it was like, just as I had been, you know, completely applied myself to being a destitute junkie, I did the same thing with, then, it, you know, when that was over, it was like, okay, now I'm going to write. And I just, you know, threw myself into it completely and never, you know, and like, there were times where I didn't have any money and stuff and a hard time paying the rent, but I refused to like embark on some career that wasn't what I wanted to do. And I worked, you know, all these crappy jobs and, you know, got by living on very little, but was determined not to like, not to me, selling out is like not doing what you love. And cause people sometimes say, oh, being on MTV, isn't that selling out? It's like, no, selling out would be working in a corporation for me, you know? So, I was just very determined, you know, and I worked hard.
I guess it's been good for you that MTV has become really interested in spoken word.
Yeah, it has. I mean, you know, it's really as a result of that that I'm now paying, you know, earning my living doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'd been doing what I'm doing for, you know, a number of years and just, you know, making a little money and doing all right. But then, you know, I was on MTV and it just really changed everything. You know, all suddenly I had, you know, a manager, an agent, a lawyer, a record deal, you know, movie auditions, you know, all this stuff.
Well, I want to play one more track from your record, and I thought we'd go out with The Stupid Jerk I'm Obsessed With.
Oh, okay.
You want to say anything about writing this?
You know, it was just... you know what happened, actually? It was this bad character actor. It was this guy I was obsessed with, and he came to one of my readings one time, and he said something horrible to me after the reading. I was like, so what did you think? And he said... Well, I liked that one poem, but everything else was completely self-indulgent. And I was, you know, I was like appalled. And I just said, oh, fine. You know, and I stormed home and I turned on my little computer and I was like, I'll show you self-indulgent. And I was like, that stupid jerk I'm obsessed with, you know, and I just, it spouted out of me.
Okay, Maggie Estep, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Maggie Estep's new CD is called No More Mr. Nice Girl.
Stupid jerk I'm obsessed with stands so close to me. I can feel his breath on my neck and smell the way he would smell if we slept together, because he is the stupid jerk I'm obsessed with, and that is his primary function in life, to be a stupid jerk I can obsess over and to talk to that dingy bimbette blonde as if he really wanted to hear about her manicures and pedicures and new age ritualistic enema cures, and truth be known, he probably does want to hear about it because he is the stupid jerk I'm obsessed with, and he's obsessed.
Maggie Estep from her new CD, No More Mr. Nice Girl. This is Fresh Air. There's some news on the healthcare reform front. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's the news?
Well, apparently the shape of a compromise on health care can be dimly perceived, and we'll have several reports trying to flesh it out and figure out what it is. Brown and Williamson executives are testifying before Congress today on their decision to create a high-nicotine tobacco. We also have a study on rape from the Department of Justice, which says that most rape victims are under 18. We'll be reconsidering that Friday night ride with O.J. Simpson, in which we watched a man driving a car and speculated about what it might mean. And the reduced Shakespeare Company offers us Hamlet in way under a minute.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When they first came along in the early 80s, the Beastie Boys seemed like a novelty act, three young white men appropriating the conventions of rap music. But four albums into their career, the Beastie Boys are making quirky, original music. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of their new release, Ill Communication.
In case you couldn't make out the words in its distorted vocal, that was the Beastie Boys, the guys who used to be primarily interested in fighting for your right to party. Now they're rapping the praises of Buddhism. These once and future wise guys are putting big beats behind couplets such as, I give thanks to this world as a place to learn, and for this human body I'm glad to have earned. The specific reason for this is that one Beastie Boy, Adam Yauch, is a recent convert to Buddhism. But more generally, what the Beastie Boys are trying to do here is open up the subject matter of hip-hop music to make it accommodate anything that occurs to them.
So just sit back and relax, I'm a jackson, a kid, you like it?
That song, called Flute Loop, uses a musical hook that baby boomers will recognize as a famous riff from the Blues Project's 1966 song Flute Thing. Like many of the best rap musicians, the Beasties cut and paste bits of rock history together, fashioning a collage that creates something new. In their case, the Beastie Boys are making their own contribution to what is essentially an African-American pop form by combining rap with their other musical passion, which is punk's hardcore music. The result is a chaotic, roiling sound that's nonetheless very artfully assembled.
Oh, yes, indeed, it's fun time, fun time.
Because you care, you want, and you don't stop.
It's pretty admirable the way the Beastie Boys have, as the years have gone by, increased their credibility. They do lots of performances for charities. They have their own record label called Grand Royal, which is also the name of a very funny fan magazine that they publish. And they're rapping sentiments that haven't been heard much in this genre. Part of the song I just played, Sure Shot, is a plea to reject the misogyny that's become standard content in a lot of rap. Who'd have thought the Beastie Boys would become a conscience for their generation?
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl, technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our interns are Abby Beshkin, Philo Holland, Mark Tullis, and Marcus Tossig. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, an interview with British rock star Elvis Costello. We'll also hear from songwriter and singer Nick Lowe, who was Elvis Costello's first record producer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.